ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, I'm Nick Grimm, and this is PM coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, sexual violence and harassment in the ranks. Female military personnel part of a new class action against the Australian Defence Force. Hamas tells the ABC it's preparing for renewed hostilities with Israel inside Gaza. And last man standing, Australian Phil Gore takes out a major multi-day endurance event after running his competitors into the ground, then heading straight into his wife's arms.
Oh, he's deep.
Everyone's so excited to see Phil win. We all knew that he had it in him, but the opposition he had was incredible.
The Australian Defence Force is facing fresh accusations that women serving in its ranks were subjected to sexual violence and harassment. A Brisbane law firm has launched a class action in the federal court today and says every woman who served in the Defence Force over a 22-year period will be eligible to join. The action will claim the ADF provided an unsafe workplace for female personnel. With more details on the case, reporter Laura Lavelle spoke to me a short time ago. Laura, the lawyers bringing this class action are describing it as a landmark proceeding. Now, how many women are expected to become a part of it?
Well, Nick, this is really a watershed moment for the women of defence, and especially those who have been the victim of sexual violence, harassment or discrimination in the workforce. And that's because a class action of this type and size against defence has never been seen before, because the lawsuit is being run on what's called an opt-out basis. That means that defence will have to notify all women who have served between November 2003 and May this year of the class action, and they'll automatically be eligible for the action. They'll automatically be a part of the class action unless they haven't been impacted, and they can then opt out. But certainly, the law firm behind this action is expecting thousands, if not perhaps 10,000 women, to be a part of this claim.
And take us through the claims that have been outlined in today's court filing.
Well, it alleges that service women are being subject to widespread and systemic sexual violence, harassment and discrimination. It's being led by four lead applicants. They're anonymous, but we know that they hail from separate parts of the force. One woman says that she was forcefully groped and kissed. Another says that her boss would daily rub his crotch against her so that she could feel his genitals. But all women have one thing in common. They say that once they reported what had happened to them, they were made to feel like the problem, not their alleged perpetrators. And the ABC has spoken with several ex and current serving members whose stories have really been horrendous, Nick. And one woman told us her boss threatened to rape her into submission if she didn't follow orders. Another overheard a conversation between a male colleague where one said that all women were pigs and they deserved to be shot. But really, what this class action aims to do is a few things. The first, the lawyers say, is to vindicate the victims of sexual assault and harassment in the force, to give them a voice, to elicit change, and obviously there is a compensation element as well. But for the women that I've spoken with, they say it's not about the money, and no amount of money can give you back the dignity that's been stripped when you are sexually assaulted, but it can go part of the way to helping to validate you.
So has the ADF responded to the legal action as yet?
Nick, they have. They said to me that there is no place for sexual violence or misconduct in defence. It acknowledges there is work to be done, but it is developing comprehensive sexual misconduct prevention strategies, which they are implementing. It's also working to improve education and training for its members too. But Nick, there's been countless inquiries, reports, investigations, media coverage, and recently, you probably remember, a Royal Commission as well. An entire section of the findings and recommendations of that Royal Commission was dedicated to sexual misconduct against women in the Defence Force. So at least for the women that I'm speaking with, they're hoping that this really is the catalyst for change, and they ask, if it's not, then what will it take?
And what are we expecting to be the next step in the legal proceedings?
Well, the next step is that in about 6 weeks' time, this matter will head back to court. A judge will make a ruling about whether the four lead applicants will be able to remain anonymous or if they will strip their anonymity. But really, the lawyers have told me that it's in defence's hands from then on how long they want to fight this or if they want to fight this.
Laura Lavelle, the reporter there. Testing is yet to confirm it for certain, but it's looking ominously like the deadly H5 strain of bird flu has reached Australian territory following the discovery of dead elephant seals on subantarctic Heard Island. Wildlife experts who travelled to the island on board an icebreaker observed an unusual number of the dead animals in recent days, and they believe avian influenza is most likely responsible. Scientific testing to confirm that view, though, is unlikely to be conducted for several weeks, with samples from the possibly infected animals still to make the long ocean voyage back to the mainland. Luke Radford explains.
4,000 kilometres southwest of Australia is a remote strip of volcanic rock called Heard Island. It's uninhabited, but it's Australian territory, and Australian scientists occasionally visit. But when they arrived this year, they noticed something unusual, larger than normal numbers of dead elephant seal pups. The cause is believed to be the deadly H5 strain of bird flu. It's a day Megan Dewar from Federation University has long expected.
When we saw this morning, we weren't surprised, given the close proximity of Heard Island to the French subantarctic islands, which were affected with avian influenza late last year and early this year. We did expect it to arrive at Heard and also potentially McDonald Island sometime this season.
H5 is a specific strain of bird flu that spreads incredibly fast and is lethal to wildlife. It's spread to every part of the globe except for Australia. But experts say its arrival here is only a matter of time. Dr. Dewar says now that the virus is likely on Heard Island, it could spread to other nearby Australian territories.
It's most probable this virus has either come from the subantarctic French islands or from South Georgia. So that's where it originally moved from, into the French subantarctic islands. It's moving now around to Heard and potentially McDonald Island. These species will then often move around and migrate to Macquarie Island and the New Zealand subantarctic islands. And then we have species that move from those islands up towards New Zealand and Australia.
The federal government has stressed that this is only a suspected outbreak. The test results won't come till November. Julie Collins is the federal agriculture minister.
We are as prepared as we can be. Our government has invested over $100 million in being as prepared as we can be. Some of that money has flowed to states and territories in terms of mobile laboratories and testing equipment. Some of it has gone to Wildlife Health Australia to do more surveillance. Some of it has gone to zoos and aquariums to protect native species.
Experts say that preparation is essential. While the disease is still a long way from the Australian mainland, when it arrives, it will be devastating. Dr. Michelle Villa is a World Health Organisation avian flu researcher based in Melbourne.
Globally, it's impacted more than 400 species of wild birds. And for some species, it's having population level consequences. So, for example, in the country of Peru, about 40% of all the Peruvian pelicans died within months of this virus arriving. It has also impacted a diversity of mammal species, and particularly marine mammals like seals. So again, in South America, at least 30,000 South American sea lions have died.
In the meantime, farming groups will be taking extra precautions. The egg industry has only just recovered from an outbreak of the less lethal H7 bird flu strain, which was successfully eradicated earlier this year. Brian Ahmed is president of the Victorian Farmers Federation Egg Group.
Australian egg farmers and all poultry farmers have been on high alert since the bird flu outbreaks about 2-3 years ago, particularly here about this H5 strain this close to our shores will mean that we'll just take a lot more precaution and up our biosecurity as much as we can.
Wildlife organisations are also doing what they can to prepare. Dr. Carol Booth is Policy Director at the Invasive Species Council.
Australia is well prepared and has many times faced down the threat of bird flu for poultry. This would be the first time we've had outbreaks in wildlife, and it's obviously much more difficult. You cannot get rid of bird flu in wildlife, so it's about preparing for it.
There's also a vaccine that's been developed, but Dr. Booth says it won't be possible to use it on wild animals.
The focus will primarily be on wildlife in captivity, threatened species that are being bred highly threatened species to reintroduce into the environment. So it's really important, but it's definitely not going to be widely applied because the vaccine that's being used, you know, the birds would have to be caught twice for vaccination, and that's just not feasible for most wildlife.
H5 bird flu can spread to humans. There were 70 cases in the US last year and one death, mainly among farm workers. Authorities say while there have been severe cases, the current risk to humans is low.
That report by Luke Radford and ABC Rural's Warwick Long. The search for alleged police killer Desmond Freeman has been scaled down by Victoria Police 8 weeks after two officers were gunned down on a rural property in the state's Alpine region. Task Force Summit will take over the ongoing search for the fugitive and has been tasked to comb through hundreds of pieces of intelligence. It comes as business operators in the area hope the reopening of Mount Buffalo National Park will help drive local tourism through the summer months ahead, after the manhunt brought an abrupt end to the snow season. Kimberly Price reports.
It's been a quiet few months for businesses in parts of Victoria's Alpine region. After the killing of two police officers in August, the town of Porepunkar in the foothills of Mount Buffalo National Park has seen tourism come to a standstill. The alleged shooter, Desi Freeman, remains at large. But Misty Rose Wilson, who runs the Porepunkar pub, is hoping the reopening of the park will soon bring visitors back to the area.
We were nervous that they hadn't opened it for a little while there and over the September school holidays. And did that deter people? I'm sure it did at that time. And now that it's open, we're so excited because that's right, we are at the base of Mount Buffalo. We really facilitate all the tourists going up there and enjoying those amazing views of the Great Dividing Range.
The alleged double murder of police officers Neil Thompson and Vadim Devart Hotar happened at the end of the region's snow season and is normally a busy time for Porepunkar. But for weeks, the town was in lockdown while police combed the rugged terrain for any sign of Desi Freeman. Now, Misty Rose Wilson says the town is opening for a collection of events to fundraise a community garden that could help boost tourism.
We've always been the heart of Porepunkar, and so we really want to be a space where people just feel safe, you know, and that they can come and enjoy again, whether it be good food and drink or good country hospitality.
The reopening of Mount Buffalo National Park coincides with Victoria Police transferring the search for Desi Freeman to a new task force called Summit. Based in the Great Alpine area, Task Force Summit will involve the Fugitive Armed Crime, Special Operations and Search and Rescue Squads, among other resources. Macquarie University criminologist Dr. Vincent Hurley explains the decision to downgrade the search is an indication of where things stand.
They have exhausted all their inquiries and now they are relatively happy that they have done everything they can, they've covered every lead that they can. And now, for want of a better phrase, situation has simmered down. So now they can disband some of the police from interstate as well as from Victoria to let them go back to normal duties and leave a core set of police officers and various units now to carry out that investigation.
Victoria Police says over 1,700 pieces of intelligence have been investigated. Dr. Hurley believes Task Force Summit will look into leads previously put on hold, including others who, like Desi Freeman, hold sovereign citizen ideology.
I'm thinking that the task force could also be set up to follow leads that they previously didn't have but have put on the back burner. There are other right-wing extremists that would be on the police radar as well. But certainly the unusual behaviour of a sovereign citizen where they generally don't go to this form or extreme lengths of violence certainly would make them look at others and reassess their activities.
Police did not reveal whether they believe Desi Freeman is still alive. Bushcraft Survival Australia instructor Gordon Dedman says it's unlikely a fugitive could remain at large after 8 weeks.
If he was moving, since he would definitely, he would have been seen by now, because if he is staying in the one place, eventually that would be found, even if it's really, really hidden.
In order to survive, Gordon Dedman believes a stockpile of supplies and clothes would be needed. However, he says the human body can survive on a small amount of food for many weeks.
Within the first few days, your body uses up your energy in your liver and the blood. Once that's gone, your body turns to ketosis, which is your body's sort of use of fats for energy. And then after the fat stores are gone, the body turns to the muscles as a form of energy until there's nothing left. That process on average is about 3 weeks or 30 days in a normal adult. But people are gone for much, much longer. But eating just a little bit, even just plant food, and you're actually going to extend that way past 8 weeks. So it's actually not that hard.
Victoria Police has offered a reward of up to $1 million for information leading to Desi Freeman's arrest.
Kimberly Price reporting. You're listening to PM. I'm Nick Grimm. And remember, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The militant group Hamas says it will disarm if a Palestinian state is established. The ABC has been informed by a representative of the group inside Gaza that Hamas is taking control of security in the territory and is preparing for renewed hostilities if Israel breaks the ceasefire. The armed group also says those who collaborated with Israeli forces during the war are being punished. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Hamas is back on Gaza's streets and asserting its authority. Since the ceasefire came into effect, shocking videos have emerged of public executions and beatings in Gaza City. In an interview in the central city of Deir al-Balah, Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasim told the ABC that security forces are killing gang members who took Israeli money and weapons.
Those who collaborated with the occupation and formed gangs that support the occupation army are very clearly judged. It is the right of the government agencies to implement the law in a strict way on them, as they have committed a major crime against the Palestinian people.
Hamas is listed as a terrorist organisation by countries including Australia. It's ruled Gaza largely unchallenged and with brutal force since 2007, although Israel killed most of the group's leaders in the war. Oded Elam is a former head of counter-terrorism for Israel's spy agency, the Mossad, now a researcher at the Jerusalem Centre for Security and Foreign Affairs.
Right now, the Hamas is trying to regain power, to regain its troops, to recruit new members. They just appointed three governors to rule certain areas in Gaza.
Disarming Hamas will likely be the hardest part of the next phase of ceasefire negotiations. The group's reportedly discussing the possibility of surrendering its rockets, but keeping guns and anti-tank missiles in case Israel invades Gazan cities again. Hazem Qasim says the group will only surrender weapons to a Palestinian security force.
Hamas can give up the weapons if we are given unnatural rights according to international law and resolutions related to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state on the lands occupied in 1967 with Jerusalem as its capital. Then we can talk about giving these weapons to the bodies that will govern the Palestinian political system.
The Israeli Prime Minister has repeatedly said he'll never accept a Palestinian state. During the war, many Gazans protested against Hamas, blaming the group for the death, deprivation, and destruction in the Strip. Hazem Qasim says Hamas no longer wants to be the government in Gaza, but must be replaced by Palestinians.
Hamas says clearly that it does not want to be in any of the administrative arrangements that deal with the governing of Gaza in the so-called day after. Hamas has clearly abandoned this matter and agreed that there will be a committee of independent figures who will administer the Gaza Strip after the war.
Israel is already striking Gaza again, accusing Hamas of breaking the ceasefire, and its troops still control more than half of the Strip. If there's no meaningful peace process and Israeli troops don't leave Gaza, observers expect Hamas will stay in control, and Gaza will essentially remain at war. Dr. Erik Skare, a researcher from the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs who studies Hamas, says the failure to resolve the political situation of the Palestinian territories helps keep Hamas in power.
If a ceasefire and if a peace strike is not connected to an Israeli withdrawal, if it's not connected to a Palestinian state, and if it's not connected to an improvement of the human rights conditions of the Palestinians, then that will only cement the status quo that has proven to be quite unstable and explosive.
Leaving Gazans trapped between Israeli troops and Hamas.
Eric Torchek reporting. Finally today, just a warning, this next story might be the sort of stuff to either inspire or possibly just horrify. West Australian Phil Gore has just taken out a major endurance sporting event in the US state of Tennessee, and it's not just any ordinary feat of endurance. The Backyard Ultra World Championship, as it's known, requires competitors to run a 6.7 kilometre course every hour and maintain that grueling routine for usually days on end. The last competitor standing is crowned the champ, and today the Australian athlete took out that title. Isabel Massali has our report.
A cheer for the last remaining runner as a headlight emerges from the darkness. After running for nearly 5 days, Phil Gore ran into the arms of his wife Gemma. Lucky for you, you can't smell this story. The West Australian firefighter won the Backyard Ultra World Championship in Belbuckle, Tennessee, by completing 114 laps of a 6.7 kilometre course. That's 764 kilometres. But this extreme challenge is nothing new for the 39-year-old. Earlier this year, he set a new world record of 119 laps at a Queensland event.
Oh, you done? That's it.
Forever.
Forever. No more backyards.
He was asked by the Backyard Ultra Channel live stream what his first feeling was after crossing the finish line.
I'm just tired. I just want to sleep. There's been a lot of times throughout this event where I've been really confused. Like I was out running on the road by myself and I was like, how did I get here? What am I doing? Yeah, it's definitely been an adventure.
After hopefully getting some rest, he explained the challenging logistics to the ABC.
Basically, you get 1 hour to complete the 6.7Ks. So for me, a quick time would be sort of high 30s, low 40s, which would give me about 20 minutes rest. So I can use that 20 minutes for whatever I want. On a good night, I'll be able to get maybe 2 hours sleep total, and that's just done like 10 to 15 minutes at a time.
Stephen Parker knows a thing or two about the Backyard Ultra. He's an ultra runner, a member of the Australian Ultra Runners Association, and has written a book about the race.
It's a small community, but the backyard community in Australia is over the moon. Everyone's so excited to see Phil win. We all knew that he had it in him, but the opposition he had was incredible.
He explains this particular track is on a Tennessee property named after the founder's dog, Big.
There's tree roots, there's rocks, there's tiny creek crossings. There's actually one tree in the middle of the course that you have to actually climb through every single lap, and people come to hate it after a while, and it's probably one of the hardest courses in the world.
Stephen Parker has interviewed Phil Gore before and says he's been on a relentless pursuit of improvements and has picked up some tricks, including hypnotherapy, for those short naps.
Phil would have a regimented plan for what he'd do every hour, I'd guess up to 200 hours, where each lap it would clearly say, I will eat this, I will drink this, I will sleep this long, and I will run at this pace. So he'll say, hey, this is going to be a fast lap, so then I can sleep more. Or this lap, I'm going to try and have a quick bath or have my feet washed.
But the race isn't about being the fastest. Instead, you need to outlast your opponents. Many people suffer massively through the seemingly endless loop.
There was one guy who was vomiting for about 24 hours straight. Most laps he was vomiting. The Russian, Eisen Zaborski, when he finished, he couldn't run on a straight line. He said physically he felt fine, but he was so dizzy he couldn't run straight. So another year, one of our guys was urinating blood. There's quite serious physical problems that come from people doing this. But it seems that Phil has trained himself adequately and sustains himself well through his rest and nutrition during the race that he can then back it up the next day and keep going.
The event also saw a new women's world record. Sarah Perry from the UK ran 95 laps, smashing the old record of 87.
The relentless pursuit of improvement, as they say. Isabel Massali with that report. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Nick Grimm. We'll be back on Monday evening. Have a great weekend. All the best. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Ahead of his election, Donald Trump promised to deport millions of undocumented migrants. At one point, he even predicted 20 million people would be removed from America. So where is he up to with his pledge? Today, Caitlin Dickerson from The Atlantic magazine on how the president's campaign is about to ramp up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.